My name is June and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of this conference. And Larry, thank you for your help with this and all the Zoom meetings that you've been helping everybody with. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really consider it a privilege to be a part of this, and particularly in the Zoom format, because I think that all of us, or maybe most of us, have recognized during this past year and a half that Zoom has a purpose, and that it is another way for one alcoholic to talk to another. And the language of the heart is alive and well on Zoom and in person. So whatever way people are choosing to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is available. And you know, for me, the Zoom format has made it really wonderful because there's an ability, just like Mary was sharing this morning about, you know, Clancy being able to travel around the world and share the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Zoom is allowing us to do that. You know, yesterday I was in India, you know, and during these last few months, actually, I've had the privilege with a number of members of my online home group who are here on Zoom today to go to a lot of different countries and to see that Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well and thriving, and people are getting sober on Zoom or otherwise. And I also, you know, wanted to mention that because of this format, it's allowing a lot of people to get to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that might not have otherwise been able to. Like, for example, this morning, when you guys were doing the countdown, we have a member on Zoom who's from the first generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Joan S. from San Diego got sober in 1957, and she's held many service positions over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous and specifically at this conference. And I've had that privilege also of holding some service positions at the Southern California Convention during years. And this was the first convention I ever went to. And when I went there, I had less than 90 days. And I remember it much more clearly, actually, than some of the other years in my sobriety. I was super uncomfortable. There were literally thousands of people there. I didn't have enough money to pay for a badge, but they gave me like a scholarship and they let me come to the meetings anyway. And I sat in the corner on the floor a lot, and I went to a lot of the marathon meetings because they went all night long and I didn't have a place to be. And I remember the final speaker on Sunday morning. I was telling Joan yesterday, it was a woman named Wynne Laws, and her story was freedom from bondage in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It happened to be one of the stories that that I had read and related to. And I had that privilege of meeting her, another one of the first generation, you know, members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm from a family that has had problems with alcoholism on both sides for years, long before Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I've had members of my family die in car crashes while drunk driving. And my father died in a hotel room alone before he was 50 years old, drinking himself to death. My mother is an alcoholic, and she was the person who was going to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years with varying lengths of sobriety. Today, she's been continually sober for 17 years. So alcoholism has been on both sides of my family. And who knows where I'm going to go here with my talk this morning, but I do have three children. And I assume that possibly one of those three children may one day have some children. And the fact is that I want to do everything that I can to make sure that Alcoholics Anonymous continues to be alive and well in the same way that it was when I got here. So that it can be passed on. And I do believe now that that's going to include Zoom, because we have a broad and roomy highway. And I think it's wonderful that we're going to have that option. You know, I'm a person who believes that I was born an alcoholic, and I don't know that that's particularly important, but there was definitely something wrong with me before I ever started to drink or, you know, anything. And it doesn't really matter because science isn't going to be able to prove that yet or not. But as I've said, with my history and my family, there's certainly a chance, you know, that I would have had problems. And for me, my first obsession actually before alcohol became an obsession with suicide, because life hurt too much for me. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up with a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of broken promises. I grew up with a lot of other kinds of abuse that were happening on a regular basis in my life. And by the time I was five, I was just done. I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't want to feel anything anymore. I didn't believe there was anything good to feel. I didn't really know. I didn't believe in any way it was going to get better, ever. And so I'm a person who wanted a way out. And the first way out that I found was to focus on the idea of suicide so that I wouldn't have to feel. And since I'm still here, you can see that despite the fact that I really did try a lot of suicide attempts, it didn't work. But luckily for me, I'm one of those people that gets an unusual reaction to alcohol. And alcohol gave me a way out for a while so that I didn't have to feel, so that I didn't have to hate myself in my life all the time the way that I always had. And, you know, I was thinking about it, you know, the other day, and I was recognizing that in a way, alcohol gave me a daily reprieve. When I was able to drink it, gave me a break, from who I was and how I lived and how I felt. And I'm very grateful that alcohol did that for me. But by the end of my drinking, which was not nearly as long as probably almost anybody else in this room or on this Zoom call, alcohol wasn't working the same way anymore. I was getting as physically drunk as I ever had, but I wasn't shutting down the feelings. And, interestingly enough, I loved finding out many years later that they were originally going to call the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous the Way Out, because I'd needed a way out for as long as I could remember. And here it is. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has proven to be a way out for me and countless others. You know, I have had the psychic change that we can have here in Alcoholics Anonymous if we don't drink no matter what, and if we continue to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous and try and practice these principles, you know, in our life. So, you know, in my drinking, since the main thing that I was hoping that alcohol would allow me to do, and to a large extent it did, was to not feel, that's kind of how I got by. But I was always trying to manage my emotions and always trying to not get hurt, because I was, like Clancy used to talk about, I was a person who seemed to have been born without any emotional insulation whatsoever. And, you know, in my life, I went to 18 grammar schools, 7 junior highs, 5 high schools, moved a lot. And I got teased a lot, you know, as the new kid. And when I first got sober, I could really remember with perfect clarity what some of those people were saying, what they were wearing, where they were standing, and the intense pain that I felt when they would tease me about how I looked or my curly hair or whatever it was. Because I have always been, as far as I can remember, I've always been very self-centered. I've always been thinking about me and my feelings and my pain. And so I found, you know, like I said, that alcohol worked for a while until it didn't. My mother had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to come here. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be in an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it, because I blamed her for everything that had gone wrong in my life. And a lot had gone wrong. But by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I was getting physically drunk, it wasn't shutting off the pain anymore. And that was a pretty terrible place to be. And I'll tell you, you know, and I've been saying this for a while now, honestly, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if they would have, the old timers, the people that were here, if they'd have sat me down and said, June, if you go back out there and you keep drinking the way that you're drinking, you're going to be dead in 6 months. We promise you that. I would have run out the door and kept drinking. But instead, what the old timers here told me is they said, if you keep drinking, it's going to get worse, never better. And lots and lots and lots of them had gone on to live another 10 or 20 or 30 years. And I have always believed that I would be one of those people that could have gone on continuing to live the way that I was living, hating myself more and more every single day that I was out there, because I actually think that that is one of the horrors of alcoholism, is that it goes on for a long, long time, and that we're isolated and alone, and it doesn't get any better. So I'm grateful that they told me that, and I definitely felt like I was at the jumping off point when I got here. I did not believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for someone like me. I was angry. I was broken. I was scared. You know, I was all the emotions that most of us come in here with. And I heard people saying things. It was very much like they were speaking a different language. And I think that they were. And I just thought that what they're talking about and the way that they're living could never work from where I came from, the way that I lived. And I did not really believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for me the way that it was working for these people that I heard sharing. And yet I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work. You know, there was something very genuine, and there still is here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have seen and heard all these years. And, you know, it also meant a great deal to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was absolutely free. It still does. The fact that we don't have to pay anything to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket at the Seventh Tradition on anything like a regular basis. And it's funny, one time I talked at a meeting, I don't know, it's been about probably 10 years ago now, and this woman ran up to me and she said, "I remember hearing you when I was new." And you think, oh, I said something that someone heard when they were new, you know? And she said, yeah, she said, "You said that you were over 10 years sober before you could put a dollar in the basket." And she said, and I thought, what a loser. So you never know how something you share in a meeting is gonna like stick with somebody, you know? I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different ways, because luckily we have those options here. But I got active, and I went to 21 meetings a week in my early years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't trying to get a gold star in AA. I wasn't trying to get any awards. I just had no place to go that was indoors. You know, I didn't have a TV. I didn't have any friends. My family didn't want anything to do with me and did not invite me into any activities until I was probably about 5 years sober. In fact, you know, I went to the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 3 years sober. Alcoholics Anonymous was celebrating 40 years that time. It was 1975. It was in Denver. And I took a red eye because those were the cheapest flights that you could get. And someone else in Alcoholics Anonymous, a couple of old timers, Marion Chapman and B. Gray, said I could sleep on the floor of their room if I got to that international. And I took that red eye. And on that plane, there were 52 people from New Zealand that were going to the international convention. And we all stayed up all night laughing and talking, and they were crazy. And, you know, that year, that was July of 1975. And in December of 1975, I got a Christmas card from one of the guys on that plane. And I still have it. I just moved a couple years ago, and I still have that Christmas card because I wasn't getting Christmas cards yet from my family, but people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, were starting to accept me and let me be a part of. So, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a rotten attitude, and I kept it for a long time. It was the only attitude I'd ever had. I did not like women. I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to talk to women. I didn't want to sit next to women, and I certainly was not going to hug women, and I mostly didn't. I didn't like men. The only men I'd ever known usually beat up women. And I figured the guys in AA, you know, said that they were alcoholics. I figured they probably were beating somebody up too. And I didn't want anything to do with them either. And so I just sat in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did what I could to keep people away in whatever way I could. And I had a lot of different ways that I could use. And I was actually pretty successful. I mean, sometimes I was alone in a whole row, you know, in a meeting that was fairly full, because people did leave me alone, but they let me keep coming back anyway. I found that when I got sober, I had a very limited vocabulary. It was almost solely profanity. There were a lot of people in AA that were pretty offended by the kind of language I used. So I would use it more if they got too close to me. And I didn't wear shoes when I first got sober. I'm from a town in Los Angeles, Venice Beach. And it was very important to me that I had tough feet. I had to have the ability to walk down an alley with broken glass and step on lit cigarette butts. And these were the things that were important to me before I got sober. And so when I got sober, I didn't wear shoes either. And it wasn't like I took them off to go to the meeting. I just didn't wear shoes. And so I would go to the meeting and I would be, you know, barefoot. And I had a jacket, and on the back it said, "Do unto others and then split." And back when I got sober, most people smoked, and I smoked. And I used to after I got sober, I would smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And it wasn't really so much necessarily that I was smoking. It was more that I was holding something lit in my hand, like all the time, and just lighting one after the other because I had to have something in my hand. I mean, even today, I still have a pen that I carry, even though I haven't smoked in years, but I had to have that. And I had some chains that I wore on my wrists and one on my ankle. I'd just been beaten up by my own gang when I got to AA. So I had a black eye and I had a swollen lip. I was 87 pounds. And they made me the greeter at the Westwood group. And I love how we give out commitments. I mean, I was clearly not the best person to make as the greeter, but that's what they did. And so I would stand there, and after I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up, in addition to smoking cigarettes, I took up smoking cigars and a pipe. So I would stand there with whatever thing I was happened to be smoking, and like I said, with my black eye and swollen lip, and I would welcome the new people as they came to AA. Sometimes as they walked by, I'd hear their sponsor kind of whisper, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that, you know. And when I was first standing at that door, people were guessing my age at 37 years old. But if you had looked at my birth certificate, you would have seen that I was really only 13 years old. But I actually felt 2,000 years old. And I felt 2,000 years old for a really long time after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not believe that there was anything in these meetings, in these steps, in this book, in this literature that could ever take away being old. I mean, once you've already gone to that point, you know, and you're broken and you're damaged, how is that going to get better? And honestly, I can't tell you exactly how and when it happened. It was very slow, slower than I would have liked. That's been the experience that most of the people I've known have shared with me, is that it's been pretty damn slow. But things, you know, just started to change. And I believe personally that it had so much to do, first and foremost, with not drinking no matter what, which is the ultimate foundation, I think, of everything that we need to start with. Even though I know, and so does anybody else who's stayed sober, that not drinking alone is not enough. But it's a damn good place to start. You know, and I'm glad that was drilled into me about how important that was, that we don't drink no matter what. And then the other thing that, you know, has served me very, very well over these years has been showing up for my meetings and my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what. And those are the two things that I've done pretty close to perfectly. My sobriety date is July the 13th, 1972. So this past July, I celebrated 49 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I want to welcome you. I want to encourage you to go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, lots of conventions in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think something very special does happen there. Again, we get to see how big Alcoholics Anonymous is and meet people from different groups and areas and countries. And I think that that's really important. Because I believe one of the greatest things we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're people who normally would not mix, you know, and we're mixing. And I think it's a great strength. But I don't know where I was going to go from there. But I stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kept doing those commitments. And slowly, as I said, over time, I've had this psychic change. The very first thing I ever remember thinking about myself that was positive or good, I was close to a year sober, and I was at my Monday night Venice home group. And that night I was the literature chairperson. And I remember thinking, I'm a pretty good member of this home group. And I had never had a positive thought about myself. That's why it stands out in my mind, you know. And I'd love to tell you that, you know, from that moment on, then everything was just great. And I just, you know, loved everything about myself and loved everything about my life. That's not true. You know, there's a line in the book that I've really become attached to, in particular these last few years, because it's just really kind of jumped out at me. And it's try to avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. And I just want you to know, I didn't know about that line in the early years of my sobriety. I deliberately manufactured a lot of extra misery, you know, and I made a lot of extra problems. But I didn't drink, and I kept showing up, you know, and I stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was thinking, too, because your conference this weekend is in Palm Springs, you know, it was sort of like a combination. My very first conference was the Southern California Convention. And one of the conferences that meant the most throughout the years in my sobriety was the Palm Springs Roundup. So it's almost kind of like they're both coming together, you know, in my memory when I think about things. And my first sponsor was very active in the Palm Springs Roundup. My first sponsor was a woman named Gail Wilson, and Gail had a long time commitment there. And one of her commitments was to pick hostesses and to choose and invite people from different parts, you know, mostly in the state of California, but people that would come and that they would have a service commitment of welcoming people and showing them where things were at the conference. And despite the fact that she was my sponsor, I was not given an opportunity to have that commitment, you know, for many, many years after I was sober. Because, you know, she didn't really like my greeting attire the same way that the Westwood group apparently had accepted it. You know, I used to get teased that, you know, even after I was 7 years sober, I could have posed for atrocity posters, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was really slow. And, you know, I was thinking about Gail and about that conference today, because some really special things happened for me at that conference. And I want to check my time because I want to make sure that I'm doing okay here with that. So let's see where we are there. Okay. When, you know, the fact that I got a woman for a sponsor will always amaze me, because I've kind of told you about how I felt about women. I really didn't want anything to do with women. I didn't even sit in a row where someone was wearing pink till I was like 10 years sober, in case somebody thought I was a woman or feminine or soft or whatever it was, all the things that I associated with being a woman. And Gail was really active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I went to these 21 meetings a week for those first 2.5 years, it seemed as though a woman named Gail Wilson talked at about 18 of those meetings every week. It was like, no matter where I went to the Valley, I went to Orange County, I went, you know, wherever I went, West Hollywood, Gail was always speaking. And so I thought to myself, if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, maybe I can find out ahead of time where she's speaking and I won't have to go hear her all the time. And that's sort of what motivated me to get a woman for a sponsor. And Gail is exactly what I'm talking about when I think about that line in the book that says, we are people who normally would not mix. I mean, Gail was 3 times my age. Gail had come from a warm and loving family in the South. I hated people like that. Gail had a car. We didn't have a car, and I didn't like people who had cars. You know, Gail had gone to college, and I had only finished 7th grade. Gail had traveled all over the world. She was a stewardess and had gone all over the world, you know, during college and after college and with her job. And I had run away once from Venice hitchhiking and had made it 7 miles east to Culver City. So, you know, I didn't really have a lot of geographics or travels. And Gail not only did not use the kind of language that I used, she literally did not know what a lot of the words I was using meant, you know. And I would see her at the Thursday night Brentwood meeting, which was her home group. And I would go over and I would say hi, and she would say, June. She goes, please do not sit next to me at the meeting tonight. She goes, I cannot take your cigar smoke. And I go, well, that's fine. You know, and I would turn to walk away and go get a seat. And she'd say, and please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And I was okay with that because I didn't want anybody knowing I was hanging out with someone kind of lame like her. I mean, Gail had been seen in public wearing pink a lot of times, and it was just a disgrace to me, you know. But I would meet her secretly, and we would sort of, that's how I felt about it, and we would talk about AA. And I'm telling you now, I'm extremely grateful that they did not have caller ID, because as good an AA member as Gail was, I'm just not sure she would have answered all of my calls. I was a nightmare to sponsor. And she told me this, by the way. I'm not just making this up. And I know that there's people on this call who got a sponsor and did everything their sponsor said and never lied and was always, you know, was always a really good person. I don't know that many of those people, but I've heard that they exist. I was not one of those. I was a disaster. And, you know, Gail was just, she was really frustrated with me a lot of the time. But, you know, I kind of just kept showing up and I didn't drink. And that's kind of, those were the two things that she said is, you know, you don't drink and you show up for your AA commitments. And that was sort of, you know, what we shared in common for quite a while. And eventually I did start getting, you know, commitments at different conferences and service jobs and commitments in groups and become a secretary and, you know, and really learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous and try to give back in that way that, that Gail was doing and that a lot of other, the old timers were doing and showing up. And, you know, I ended up being, this was a transformative moment for me that I, you know, talk about sometimes. So I was at the Palm Springs Roundup 1 year. And I was about 7 years sober, not 100% sure exactly, but I was at the Palm Springs Roundup. It was the banquet. It was Saturday night. And at the banquet, well, first of all, I didn't have the money to pay for the registration. So somebody, probably Gail, had arranged for me to get a scholarship and do some kind of service job while I was there so that I could go to the conference. And then somebody else had bought me a banquet ticket. And so I was sitting at the banquet. Somebody else had given me a dress to wear, because back then, people, I don't know about, you know, last night what you guys saw, but at the banquet back in the 70s, people really, really dressed up. I mean, even in Palm Springs, it was almost kind of funny because it was July or June, I guess. And people would like bring a mink stole, you know, which you really don't need that much in Palm Springs. But they looked like they were going to the Academy Awards. I mean, they were really dressed up. So someone had given me a dress, and I was sitting there, and I was sitting at the banquet table before the meeting. And I was looking around the room, comparing myself to everyone else in the room, something I still do some days when I want to make myself miserable. So I was looking around at what, how beautiful everybody was and how they looked and how, what they were doing, and, you know, that kind of thing that we can do. And I saw a woman across the room wearing a stunning black dress. And I thought, wow, because I talked to myself, which is going to come in really handy later when I got asked to talk on Zoom, because sometimes it feels like I'm talking to myself here, especially when there's a lot of silhouettes and no humans. But anyway, so I was sitting there and I looked at this beautiful, you know, black dress. And I thought, wow, don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? Is that not beautiful? And I thought, it is beautiful, but I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I thought, what? I had to ask myself a lot more questions. I go, all right, wait a minute. What do you mean you're glad you're wearing this dress? I said, what about the green dress over there? I mean, green is your favorite color. Don't you wish you were wearing that green dress? And I thought, you know, that is, it's a beautiful dress, but I'm okay wearing this brown dress. I thought, really? And then, I mean, I was okay having curly red hair. And then I was like asking myself all these other questions. It was really unbelievable. I didn't wish I was sitting at your table. You know, the fun table. Why am I always at the loser table? All the fun people are at that table. I'm at this table. I was okay with being at that table. And then I didn't wish I had your mom. And I didn't wish I had, you know, come from your family. I didn't wish anything was different right then. And believe me, for somebody like me who had always wanted to look and feel like anybody else on the planet, this was a huge deal. But it gets even bigger than that for me. Because right then I asked myself like this other question that I couldn't even believe. I still can't believe it. Because right at that moment, I didn't want to feel different than I was feeling. And I never had that. I didn't have that before I was drinking. I didn't have it when I was drinking, because if I was drinking the right amount, I wasn't feeling anything. That's how alcohol worked for me. And I don't remember having anything like that in that first 7 years of sobriety, you know. But that night, I didn't want to feel like anybody else, look like anybody else, or be anybody else. And I'll tell you, when I got sober in 1972 in Alcoholics Anonymous, we had some very persuasive members of Alcoholics Anonymous here. There wasn't one or all of them put together that could have told me, someday, June, someday, if you keep doing these things, if you keep living like this, and if you keep not drinking, you're not going to want to trade places with anybody. I wouldn't have believed them. Never in a million years. And yet I had that moment. And I know it would make a much better talk if I told you that from the time I was 7 years sober, it's always been like that. I've never envied anybody else, never wished anything was different, never felt sorry for myself. And that would be a hell of an AA talk, but that's not my talk, because I'm still a human being and I haven't been like that. But I will tell you that now for many, many years, I don't know exactly how many, because they've kind of all blended together after 49, really, in a way, but for a long, long time now, I have known that I wouldn't trade places with anybody, you know? And I've had some tough bumps in the road in the years that I have been sober. I walked through some things that I'm pretty sure nobody on this call or anywhere else would want to walk through, just as I know people on this call who have walked through and are walking through some things right now. But I would take it all again if I had to, so that I could have the people in my life that I have, so that I could have the life that I have, and so that I could feel, you know, the way that I feel. That whole thing about the book, you know, where it says your whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. I don't know exactly when that happened. I don't know exactly how that happened, but I have had that experience here. And that makes me think of, you know, a line my friend Mary always talks about, you know, where it talks about in the book, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And it doesn't matter how many minutes or hours you guys gave me, I couldn't finish telling you all the great events that have happened, you know, in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, or the great events of some of the people that I know are at that conference and that I know are on this Zoom screen. You know, it's been absolutely incredible. When I want to tell you a little bit more about my first sponsor and a little bit more about my early days. You know, I finished school seventh grade when I got to AA. And when I got sober, my sponsor really wanted me to go to high school like other people do when they're in their teens. And I tried briefly, but I'm telling you, if I felt 2,000 in AA, I felt 3,000 out in a high school. It was horrible. It was just excruciating. I could not do it. And so my sponsor was very practical, and Gail said, fine, if you're not willing to do what people do to get a high school diploma, then you can get the kind of jobs that people who only have a seventh grade education can get. And that's what I did. So I got kind of crappy jobs, but they allowed me to get to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the way, I got fired a lot from my crappy jobs because I was a terrible employee, but I kept staying sober and I kept showing up. And eventually I wanted to get a driver's license, and you can't get that in California unless you have gone to high school and taken driver's ed. And since I wasn't going to high school, I needed that driver's ed class. And I found out there was a city college that I could go and take that class. And I did. I went over there and I took that class. While I was signing up for that class, there were people in the lobby at the school, and they were talking about something they called a dummy English class. And at that time, I was about 3 years sober. And at 3 years sober, if you had asked me at a meeting to read chapter 5 or the 12 traditions or something out loud, I could have done it. I would have read every word, and you would not have known anything was wrong. But on my own, when I would try and read the big book or anything, I could not hold in my head a whole sentence and remember what I had just read. And I was really sure that I'd done some kind of permanent brain damage and I was never going to get better. And I wondered as I signed up that day, I thought, I wonder if I take a dummy English class, if that could help me learn to have a memory again and to make my brain work. And so I took the two classes, driver's ed and dummy English. That's what they called it. And I took those two classes, and I completed those classes, which was really, I think, the first time that I'd ever worked those principles of doing something one day at a time outside of just staying sober in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up and I did the work as the teachers asked, and I was applying these principles in my life out there. So I did that, and I took those two classes, and then the next semester I took a couple more classes, and I kind of kept doing that for a few years. And at the end of a while, they called me in and they told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree, which I thought was a great name for a college degree. I never really planned on getting one. I didn't think I was going to get one. And then I found out there was something called a GED, and they suggested I get that so that I'd have an equivalent to a high school diploma, and I did that. And somewhere along the line, I'd come up with a dream. I don't know when I had that dream. I don't know where it came from, but I told my sponsor about the dream, and my sponsor, Gail, was very practical. She said, if you want to make a dream come true, you have to do the same footwork anybody in or out of AA has to do to make a dream come true. So I had to do that footwork, and I did. And I, after finishing the AA degree, I needed to go to more school if I wanted to make that dream come true. And I went on to a university, and I worked really hard at that, and I supported myself with all kinds of little crappy jobs, and I eventually got a garage I could rent for $40 a month, and I kept my commitments in AA, and I cleaned apartments on the weekends and sometimes worked in a restaurant and whatever jobs I could get, and kept showing up, and I graduated from a university, and then I still had more footwork to do if I wanted to make that dream come true. And I did that footwork as well, and I got a telegram, and now I'm kind of losing track of time, but I think it's been over 40 years ago now, I guess, or close to that. I got a telegram saying I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'd always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but not on that side of the table. And I did go to law school, and in case I forget to mention it, I had a really amazing career where I truly believe I was able to be of service in that field. And I had a career where I never once went to work ever, that I didn't have a day where I knew about where alcoholism takes people like me. And I knew that only Alcoholics Anonymous had allowed me not to live that way anymore and to be of service. But before I graduated from law school, it became very clear that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, who was only 48 years old, was dying of cancer. We'd known that she had cancer, but it looked like she wasn't going to pull through. And so she spent a lot of time in the hospital, and I spent some time in that hospital with her. And we talked, and, it was people would come in the room to take care of Gail, and she would stop every one of them and introduce me to these people who, by the way, did not want to meet me. But she'd say, Nurse Smith, I want you to meet Junie. She said, Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney. Of course, this is the same woman who used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. You know, and now she's introducing me to strangers. But we talked about it. And, you know, I said, hey, Gail, I said, how come you agreed to be my sponsor? She goes, that's easy. She said, because I was told to never say no, to never say no to an AA request. She goes, because I'm telling you, she said, with your background and your attitude, she goes, I never thought you could make it. She goes, I mean, you have to have been one of the biggest flakes I ever sponsored. And I sponsored a lot of people. She said, you know, I would tell you what to do and you wouldn't do it. I'd tell you what not to do and you would do it. You know, she said, you'd call me in the middle of the night. I mean, she said, you were just, you know, you were like a feral animal. It was really, I just didn't think it could work for someone like you. But I'd been told to never say no to an AA request. And she said, and I remember when you called me up and you said, you know, hey, Gail, I'm going to take some classes at school. She said, I knew you'd never finish. At that point, you were a few years sober. You'd never even gone to work 5 days in a row without making up an excuse, going late, leaving early, throwing a tantrum. I mean, whatever it was. I mean, you were just a big flake. And she said, but, you know, you did. You took a couple of classes. And she said, and then I remembered one day you called me up and you said, Gail, I think I want to be an attorney. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, that's like 8 years of school. I mean, you're a huge flake. And we talked about how come she didn't laugh? How come she didn't say, hey, let's sit down here and let's be practical. Let's talk about what can really happen for a person like you. And the thing was that the reason Gail didn't do that, she didn't set me down and give me a reality check about who I was and where I came from and the best that could possibly happen for someone like me, was because Gail had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and she'd had amazing great events come to pass in her life. And she'd seen great events come to pass in the lives of countless others. And she didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous could make possible for someone like me. And that's why she didn't tell me that. But I really like to make it clear, you know, especially if you're new, that it was not ever that Gail believed in June. It was not ever that Gail thought, oh yeah, June's going to be, you know, the most likely to succeed. June will probably be a good member of AA. You know, June's probably going to help some people. It wasn't that at all. But Gail always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'm very grateful that she did. You know, I'm very grateful that you don't have to believe Alcoholics Anonymous will work for it to work for you. And the thing is that I don't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is something where we have even that spiritual experience that I consider that I had at 7 years sober. That's not the last one that I had. It's not the last time that I learned something in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not the last time that people carried me through difficult experiences or that I've had the privilege of helping and carrying other people, you know, through these experiences. I'm going to go ahead and tell you this little story and then I think I'll stop. You know, back in our AA history, I'm not going to tell you too much. So I don't want to freak anybody out and say AA history and they all go, oh my gosh, and like want to sign off right away. But so in our AA history, you know, our co-founders, you know, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, years after, maybe 15 years after, Bill Wilson started thinking about the importance of Roland Hazard and his experience with Dr. Jung. So before AA existed, there was a guy named Roland, and Roland came from a very wealthy family. And I cannot emphasize enough how very, very wealthy he was. I've been to the town that he was from. I mean, they owned the entire town. It wasn't, you know, and they had this son who was a disgrace, and they couldn't believe, you know, what he was doing with his life after he had all these opportunities. And they sent him to see Dr. Jung, who was considered the greatest mind of the time. And Roland spent a year with Dr. Jung, about 11 months, I'm not sure exactly, you know, something like that. He spent a significant period of time talking about his issues and his drinking and all of his, you know, whatever it was. And then he left, and very quickly he started to drink again. He was horrified. And he turned right around and he went back to Dr. Jung and he goes, oh my gosh, we've done all this work. I did everything. I didn't think, why am I drinking again? You know, and Dr. Jung said, oh, He said, "I'm sorry, I really tried. Had hoped to help you, but alcoholics or people of your type, I've seen there's almost nothing that can be done." And Roland was like, "Nothing?" And he goes, "No, you're one of the hopeless people." And Roland said, well, what do you, he said, "Well, the only thing I've ever seen work is," he said, "sometimes I've seen somebody have a psychic change or a spiritual transformation." And he said, "And I've tried to make that happen for you, but apparently it didn't work because you left here and you started drinking." And Roland said, "Well, wait a minute, a spiritual transformation." He goes, "You know, my family owns a church. We built a church. I helped carve the altar at the church." And Dr. Young shook his head and he said, "No, it's not quite like that. It's a deeper thing. It's a psychic change. And I haven't been able to help you have that. That's the only time I've seen people who drink like you have any relief." And so at 15 years after Alcoholics Anonymous had existed, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Dr. Young thanking him for that contribution, which goes in the back of our big book when we have our spiritual experience appendix, And Bill wrote him a letter saying, "I don't know if you know how important your contribution was, but thousands of people are sober today and they have lives with their family and with the community and with the world. And it had a lot to do with your contribution. So we wanted to say thank you." And Dr. Young wrote back and he said, "I had no idea." He said, I never knew what happened to Roland. I had no idea that I could have helped. And that's great. And I'm paraphrasing, by the way. So I don't want to get a bunch of texts later about how I didn't say exactly what Dr. Young said, because I don't have a letter in front of me. But basically what he said was, he said, "That's wonderful. I'm very happy to know that I did something to help." He said, "But I want to mention something." He said, "It's also been my experience that it is not enough just that someone have a psychic change. The only way that they can continue to hold on to it, in my experience, seems to be if they are actively involved in a community. And that is why I believe it's important that we continue to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous, to continue to be active in service, to keep showing up, to remember that the alcoholic who still suffers is not always just the new one coming in, but some of our members who've had some really hard times, particularly these last couple of years, and, in other times." And so I think so much of what Dr. Bob, would have said about, let's just always remember to stick out our hand and to help the person, who's coming in, and to not forget where we came from. Thank you for letting me be part of your conference today.